And that is that there are there, one problem is what reason is Moshe giving Paro? Why should he let the Jews go? Is it because God gave them nobility? God said they are noble, right? And therefore they are not slaves, but God sets them free. God says it's my firstborn, so they have nobility by virtue of that they're related to God metaphorically. They're not a firstborn of God, but metaphorically they have greatness. Greatness means nobility, and therefore they are not slaves. Their nature is not to be slaves by virtue that God says so. Okay? Or no. Is Moshe telling Paro that God changed the nature of Israel? That the nature of Israel now, its very existence, its purpose is to serve God, and therefore they deserve to be free. That's what Rashi is bothered with. He's not sure when the pasuk says that God is saying, free my firstborn, is he saying, I've given them nobility? God has given them nobility? Or, in other words, they're not a slave nation? Or is the nation of Israel, its nature is very different, because before they were simply a nation. Now I have created in the nation the purpose that they should serve me. And since they should serve me, they should be free of you so that they could serve me. You see? That would be it in nature. That's what Rashi is answering. Those are the two possibilities. In other words, according to methodology, we first clarified each pasuk. We're clarifying each answer of Rashi. We just clarified one, the first answer by itself. Then we clarified the second answer by itself. But then we have to see how he's explaining the pasuk. Now there are two ways of explaining the pasuk. That's how we showed the final step. Okay? They're doing Pasuk Chaf Gimel, which says, verse 23, which says that I have sent to you to send my son to serve me, and you refuse to send him out. You Paro, you refuse to send him out. Therefore, I will kill your firstborn. Okay? Rashi says that this was the last plague. And however, he was warned first about the last plague. He was warned with it because it's the harshest. Since it's the harshest, so therefore it would give him cause to stop to think. And he brings a proof, a verse from Iyov that said God glorifies himself with his strength. What does that mean? He says, therefore, who is like you as an instructor? Who is like God as an instructor? Okay? Right? Now, what does that mean? So Rashi makes a comparison between a human being and God. He says a human being, when he wants to take vengeance on a person, he hides his words. He doesn't warn him. Right? Why? Because if he warns him, then the guy is going to look for a way out. He's going to look to deviate and have a way out. But God, he glorifies himself in his strength. What do you mean he glorifies? That with his strength you cannot escape. There's no escape, only by repentance. Therefore, he teaches you and warns you to repent, because that's the only way out. And if you don't repent, then the punishment will happen and there's no escape for the punishment. Right? That is what Rashi is saying. The question that we're going to deal with today is, how could you compare a human being to God? That's absolutely crazy. What's the comparison that he compares a human being to God? Why does he do that? Just explain God, and that's it. Why does he go through the comparison of a human being? The possibility is that maybe it'll help us understand. But the thing is, this doesn't help us understand. There's two different ways. It's two totally different things. There's the human being that warns, We know when a human being wants, he can't always carry it out. There's a lot of reasons why he can't carry it out. When God wants, he will carry it out. I mean, that's an obvious thing. Why is Rashi saying that? Don't get bogged down with the word vengeance. Over here, the word vengeance means justice. Well, you want to teach somebody something, you want to punish him, doesn't mean vengeance literally. Okay? I think the reason why he makes a comparison and tries to teach us this way is because many times, unconsciously, what we think of God is we project onto God qualities that we have. And we look at God through our own world, through our own ideas, okay? Which is really the basic and foundation of idolatry, okay? Now, we're making that comparison to deal with the emotions of the human being, how they might look at God. A lot of people think God will overlook things, God won't do it, God might not carry it through. You understand? It's just not true. God works, relates to it. It's like saying the laws of nature, I could fake out the laws of nature. Can't fake out the laws of nature. And when God intervenes, there's a certain system that he intervenes with. You can't fake out that system. It's not like a human being that you're relating on a personal level. That person makes, operates differently. Okay? So when he wants to punish or he wants to do something, he doesn't warn. Because if he warns you, then you'll get away with it. You see? Now many times we project onto God the same thing. These qualities we project onto God. You see? So he's saying the Pasuk is teaching us that God warns you beforehand what's going to happen. He'll tell you exactly what's going to happen. And you can't escape it. Just because you know, you can't escape it. You know? How God tells you is through prophecy or through Torah. He tells you certain information what the punishment is going to be. Okay? So therefore, like for instance, there are throughout the ages there are many, many tyrants that want to destroy Klal Yisrael, the nation of Israel. There are many tyrants that try to destroy Israel throughout the history of the Jew. There are always nations that try to destroy us. Now we know from Torah that nobody could destroy the Jew. And if you look at history, you see that people tried, they couldn't accomplish it throughout the ages. Yet they don't. They operate as if it's not a reality that the existence of the Jew is different than any other nation, right? But you can't change your reality. This is God's reality. It's not going to change. And them trying to destroy the Jew is like trying to break down a mountain by taking one shovel full at a time. I mean, you can get a few shovels full, and a little dirt will fall, but you're not going to get rid of the Jew. The nation of Judaism is not going to disappear. Okay? And there's many other things where God tells you about different punishments, and people act as if those things are not going to happen. God is not going to do it. It's not going to happen. It's not going to be that bad. God is merciful. He overlooks. All these arguments is looking at God as a human, as another human. That's a big mistake. That's what Rashi is saying. You cannot relate to God as a human. You're going to have terrible failures. You have to look at the system that Torah tells us, no different than the laws of nature. You can't say, I'm going to jump off a roof and nothing will happen to me because I could fly. Okay? It just doesn't work. Now the same thing going against the consequences of Torah, where God warns you and saying that they won't happen for whatever reason, don't believe it. It must happen. You can't escape it. That's why he's comparing it to a human being. Because human beings look many times at God through the eyes of a human, not through reality. And they make terrible, terrible mistakes. So what Rashi is saying, don't make a mistake at looking at God as you would look at a human. God is totally different. God says there's a punishment. It must happen. It will only way you could prevent it from happening is by repentance. Or not, it will happen. In other words, like this. A person can know the God of Israel, that he's an abstract God, and all these things. But still in all, when we look at him, when we think about God, many times without realizing it, we think about him as a human being. Okay? We relate to him as a human, and we don't even realize that we're relating to him as a human. Okay? That's what Rashi is pointing out here. There's a certain subtle way that we relate to God as a human. And that is that many times when you're told you're going to be punished, your mind immediately works out how you could do the bad thing and still get away with it. Right? You still work it out in your mind that you can still do it. You see? By God, God will tell you, so therefore, we try to, a human being, if let's say I wanted to get you not to do the thing, I'm going to try to punish you right away, and I'm not going to tell you what the punishment is so that I could catch you. You see what I mean? By God, you cannot escape. You cannot work out in your mind how I could bypass God. In other words, you use the same mental bypassing of God as you do, like you try to bypass an authority that's telling you what to do. You relate to him in the same way. Even though you know God, you know the 13 basic principles of God, you know God is not physical, you know he is different, but still in all, as a human being, we make mistakes. So therefore, one of the mistakes that Rashi is pointing out, that we think of God like a human being, that as soon as he tells us the punishment, so we work out how we could bypass the punishment and still do the bad thing. You see? What Rashi is saying, that God tells you the punishment and there's no way you could bypass it. It will happen. It must happen. It becomes like a law of nature. Like, just like you can't jump off a roof and say I could fly, it just doesn't work. The same thing, when God says there's a consequence unless you repent, that consequence will happen unless you repent. If you don't repent, there's no way of bypassing it. You understand? That's what Rashi is saying. Okay? Rashi is saying, be very careful. It's a subtle thing in the mind. You could know God 100%, but there's little quirks of the mind where you look at God and you attribute certain human qualities without even realizing that's what you're doing. Okay? So Rashi is telling you to be careful of that mistake. Another type of mistake that was mentioned here, it's not the mistake that Rashi is talking about, but it's a subtle mistake. People think that when you pray to God or you bring sacrifices to God, God needs your sacrifices. See, that's also a mistake, that you're attributing a certain human quality that God has needs. God has no needs. God is totally satisfied. All right, why he creates, I don't know. I'd have to know God why he does. But definitely the commandments is not for God. They're always a benefit for the human. Okay? It's definitely not a benefit to God, the commandments. Okay? And even my creation, why he does it, that's what King David in Psalms, he asked the question, who is man that God should even think about it, that God should deal with them? And he doesn't have an answer. Because the answer to that question lies in God's nature. Since it's impossible to know God's nature, so therefore we can't answer that question. But the particulars of the creation, we know that it's a benefit for us, not for him. In other words, it's better to say, I don't know, than to start finding human qualities in God. That is a great danger. That is what Rashi is warning us. There's a subtle way that people think of God and they attribute human qualities without even realizing it. They accept the premise that God is not physical, God is very different. In the universals, they accept all this. But in a subtle way, the particulars come out that he has human qualities. You have to be very, very careful of those, of projecting those human qualities onto God. In chapter 4 of Exodus, and verse 24, says that he was at a inn or a hotel, and God met him, and God wanted to kill him. So Rashi says, it says that he wanted to kill him. It says the angel, a messenger of God, the messenger, wanted to kill Moshe. And what's the reason? So Rashi quotes the Gemara, because he did not circumcise Eliezer's son, and he was negligent in doing that, and because he was negligent, he deserved the death penalty. Whereas Moshe deserved to die for not circumcising his son Eliezer. Okay? The question is that he's, the question is like this. God spent 7 days talking to Moshe to go on a mission. He's barely on the mission and he wants to kill him. So, I mean, what's the purpose? What's happening here? Rashi does not deal with this question, but however, you do see from here, from this fact, that God deals with justice. And if Moshe deserves, for whatever reason, if he deserves the death penalty, then even though God wants him to do it, God will have to work it out a different way. He'll carry out the death penalty on Moshe, and then he'll work it out a different way. Okay? That you see from here. That God deals with justice, and there's nobody above the law. Even Moshe Rabbeinu is not above the law. For whatever reason he deserved the death penalty, that's it. So therefore, he gets the death penalty. How God is going to take the Jews out of Egypt and take them to Mount Sinai, that's God's problem. He'll deal with it differently, without Moshe. Rabbi Yossi says that God forbid that you should say that Moshe was negligent. He says it's impossible to say Moshe was negligent. He says, but Moshe had a conflict. He says there are two problems here. On the one side, after a circumcision, an operation, there's danger to the person's life. Most dangerous time after surgery is the first 3 months. There's no problem traveling. You go in a car, you go in an ambulance, you understand? But those days, I mean, traveling was bouncing around after surgery. You could really hurt yourself. You could open up the wounds. So therefore, it's dangerous. He says, on the one hand, God said that I'm obligated to have circumcision, and because of a danger to the child's life, I should wait 3 days. On the other hand, God commanded me to go on the mission. So I have two commands of God. One is a general commandment to all descendants of Abraham that I should have circumcision. And one is a specific commandment to me that I should go out and go to Egypt on God's mission. Okay? So therefore, the question is, what should I do? Okay? So the question is, so why was he punished when he didn't give a bris to his son? That could be the correct thing. So he says, because he was on the way in the inn, means that he was involved with the involvement in the inn first. What does that mean? The Gemara that Rashi is quoting is found in the Durim on page 31, side 2, and it goes up to 31, side 2, and it goes up to 32, side 1. Now, 32, side 1, the first words is because he was involved in the inn first. Okay? So we said, what does it mean? We had the problem, what does it mean that he was involved in the inn first? So Rashi in the Gemara there says that he was involved in the inn, settling into the inn, because I guess it takes time, especially in those days, not everything is worked out so well, so there's a certain involvement that you have to be in the inn. And afterwards in the circumcision, and he shouldn't be involved in the circumcision first. And what about the fact that the child would have been in danger? In other words, he really should have had the bris first. And that inn was close to Egypt. It was so close that there would be no danger to the child. Okay? So there would have been no danger to the child. So that was the eighth day. In other words, the child was 8 days old when they came to that inn. And since it was the eighth day, the obligation of the inn came first. And the obligation of the bris of the circumcision should have come first. But the pasuk says he was involved with the inn. It says it was on the way in the inn. So Rabbi Yossi says that he was involved with the inn. Okay? So therefore, because he was involved with the inn before the circumcision, that is the reason why he was punished. And there's no problem with danger because he was so close to Egypt. So that is what Rashi is saying. The first question is, it seems like there's a contradiction in Rabbi Yossi himself. Because first Rabbi Yossi says that when the Gemara says that he was negligent, says God forbid that he would be negligent. Okay? That he would be negligent. And then, at the end he says, why was he punished? Because he was involved with the inn first. And Rashi explains, what do you mean involved with the inn? He got involved in settling in before doing the bris. Okay? So that's also negligent. So why does Rabbi Yossi say he's not negligent? Okay? He really was negligent. There are definitely Moshe did something wrong. He had to be negligent about something. Okay? Types of negligence. There's one, a blatant negligent. Okay? In other words, Moshe has the obligation to give his son a bris. And he's negligent. How is it possible that Moshe would be negligent about that? So Rabbi Yossi sets up, the first step is definitely he wasn't blatantly negligent. He, according to Rashi and Rabbi Yossi, what happened was Moshe made an investigation. I have two commands before me. The general command of bris, the particular command to me to go to Egypt. Which one comes first? So Rashi says that he was close enough to Egypt that he could do the bris and travel that little bit without causing any harm to the child. Okay? So therefore, that if he didn't make that decision, that would have been a blatant negligence. Because he removed the whole problem. Rabbi Yossi removed the whole problem by saying that there was no obvious negligence. Okay? The question is, what was the negligence? Okay? The question is, what is the danger to the child? I think the danger is that today you don't realize that you go in a car, you go in an ambulance, it's not going to affect the body that much. You understand? It doesn't. But in those days, they went by caravan, and there were bumps, and there were, the road itself was bumpy, the vehicle that they used was bumpy, the horses was, you know, it was a trotting type of thing. Could have been, so it's like shaking the baby up, or anybody after surgery, it could open up wounds. But I guess, according to Rashi, it depends how far you got to go. If you go very little, then you could go very extremely slow, get there without really upsetting the child if it's a very short pace. Let's say it was a matter of an hour, a half hour. So he says, for that amount, it could have gone. Okay? So the question is, what was his negligence? Okay? So he says, so Rabbi Yossi says, they was involved with the inn first, okay? Now, this day when he came to that inn was the eighth day. Now he definitely did the bris on the eighth day. Even if he got involved with the inn, he would have taken care of the bris on that day. The bris is the circumcision. He would have taken care of it that day, which is the eighth day. You understand? That's what Rashi is saying, that he would have taken care of it the eighth day. So the thing is what was the punishment? Is because he did not go with the zealousness. It had to show his, somehow, for some reason, he accepted the fact, look, I could do it a little later. Let me take care of my practical world first before I take care of the mitzvah world. In other words, I'm involved in the practical and the mitzvah. I could do the mitzvah today and still fulfill my obligation. It's the eighth day. But however, let me take care of the practical so we'll be settled in. You understand? And then I could take care of the circumcision. It was the zealousness. What Yossi is saying is he didn't do a wrong act. Moshe would not do a wrong act. It's the way he, for Moshe, the punishment is the way he relates to the act. The way you relate to the act. We, in other words, in today's world, I mean, we should do all the mitzvahs. But, you know what I mean? But the thing is there's a difference in the way you relate. Rabbi Yossi is not saying that Moshe would have did an incorrect thing by doing the incorrect act. There was something wrong, very simple, something wrong in the way he related to it. Let's say setting up at the inn would take him 20 minutes. Still going to have the bris. But he should have been so anxious to do the command of God that he couldn't wait. He shouldn't be able to wait, take care of the practicality. Should have done it immediately. That's what Rashi and Rabbi Yossi is saying. When these people incorrect act, it's a very subtle aspect of the act. It's not a total negligent of doing the act. That the negligent and totally not doing the act. The negligence has to be in something subtle and very deep for them to be negligent in. He's not saying that he wasn't negligent. When he argued against that he was negligent, he was just saying that obvious type of negligence could not have been Moshe. It was something more subtle, where he pushed off maybe 15 minutes, 20 minutes, the bris just to settle in. That showed a certain, like, the love of the mitzvah, being drawn to the mitzvah totally and completely, where he couldn't wait to do it. He had to do it. He was drawn to it immediately. And he got involved in the practical, that for Moshe was a mistake. That was where he was negligent. The question is that maybe Moshe was just getting taken care of the practical so he could take care of the circumcision. What happened by Abraham, it says he saddled up the donkey. He also took care of the practicality. But he couldn't travel 3 days without a donkey, Abraham. Okay? So, but there's certain practicality that you cannot do, that's impossible to do the act without doing practical preparation. There is certain practical preparation that just for convenience has nothing to do with the act. What the Torah is telling us, according to Rabbi Yossi and Rashi, is that this was a practicality that he could have waited. It was a certain type of convenience to get out of the way, an obligation to get out of the way, or to make it more convenient, whatever it was. But it wasn't necessary for the act of the bris. So therefore, what they're saying, that subtlety, that practicality, was for Moshe negligent. That's what he's saying.
The question that we're dealing with is that why do we have to go into depth in the different psukim? Why can't we just learn it superficially? So why do we go into depth in the different verses? Okay? Now, in every science, okay, the stars, how were the stars formed? What caused them to form? What causes dust? And then the dust becomes thicker, the gravity of the dust starts pulling it together, and that's the way a star is made. All science is looking for is theories, concepts, ideas. And these concepts and ideas you have the physical world works. Okay? Now in medicine we always know we see the symptoms, right? And then the doctors try to find the cause of the symptom. When they find the cause of the symptom, then they're able to start looking for a cure. They do not look for a cure until they find the cause. Okay? The main important thing is how we live our lives and how we think. How we think and how we live our lives, how we put that thought into action. But insofar as our subject, Mussar, about acting in life, there is a way of acting in life based on how I experience. As a result of my experience, I have a certain experience and I react to that experience. I'm affected by the outside world and I have certain feelings and I react to those feelings. That's one way of acting. There's another way, by understanding what this information is telling me and analyzing it. I could get a punch in the face and I could get a shot from a doctor. Both cause me pain. Okay? Now a little child doesn't know the difference and he hates both. Anybody that would smack him or give him a shot or anything else, the child reacts based on the experience, not on the facts. An adult at a certain point recognizes that the smack deserves one type of reaction, while the shot deserves a different, maybe appreciation for saving your life, even though it causes you pain. So therefore, you start interpreting the information around you. What our sages did, and what the subject of Mussar does, is that it analyzes life in two aspects. One is, one aspect is how to make decisions, how to act. Okay? So there I study and I start thinking, I train myself to think in a certain way. Now, in other words, I can't learn a pasuk and apply the pasuk. That's not the way Mishlei works. The way Mishlei works is I study the pasuk and start thinking in a certain way about life. And pasuk after hundreds of thoughts this way, I start thinking in a certain way so that I start making decisions based on the facts that I know, not based on an experience. Okay? That's why we call the person the chacham. Because the thing is that right now I experience, well, all my friends are smoking. I want to be one of my friends, so I feel like smoking. So people smoke. And there is, smoking leads to many problems. You see? So I don't experience now. I only know from the overall picture that I should not smoke. Because it'll lead to an addiction, and that addiction will lead to tremendous amount of problems. So therefore I should not. I do not make my decision based on the immediate, but I evaluate the immediate desire in relationship to the result. Also, we want to know what causes me not to, in other words, what causes me to want to do the immediate and not to do the overall picture, which is better for me. So then I have to know psychology. I also want to be happy. My understanding of happy, I'm defining it my way, as a lack of conflict. So therefore, to remove conflict, I have to know human nature. So I have to study the understanding of human nature, where my conflicts work and how to deal with conflicts. So I should remove my conflicts. So I have to know the causes. In other words, there's two aspects. There's actions, decisions. So, but to make the decision, I have to know the causes. The causes is my emotions. And then I want happiness, so I have to find the emotions that cause me the conflict. What causes me to do, have a desire to do something, but yet I shouldn't do it, so I'm in conflict. I have conflict within the emotions that I don't even know what they are, so I have to find out what they are. To cure it, I have to find the cause. So Musar, all these questions that we ask, is trying to understand, and then when, as we ask the questions, it's a guide to understanding how the human being works and how the human being should deal with that part of it. But it's not to deal with this or that pasuk, or to apply the principles of this or that pasuk. It's to get involved in the discussion through the questions and answers that we have here, and the analysis that your mind starts thinking in a certain way, and then in a certain subject, namely decisions, making decisions about life. And so after a while, you start thinking this way naturally. I mean, if you try to think this way, like force yourself to think this way before you're ready, you'd be in conflict. You'd be going crazy. You wouldn't know what, you know what I mean? Like you're forcing yourself to think in a way that you naturally don't think. So you can't. Musa has been developed. You naturally think a certain way and act based on that thought. Okay? That's the reason why we go into and try. We're in chapter 4, verse 24, and it's the second half of Rashi. And basically it says that a messenger of God came as a snake and started swallowing Moshe from his head down to his loins. Then he also simultaneously started swallowing him from his feet until he came to what Rashi says, that place. Now, the Torah always speaks in a very pure way, and it doesn't mention certain parts of the body. So it's talking about the penis, basically, and it's saying that thing stuck out. Okay? And the snake swallowed him, the whole body, from the head, and then it came about and started with the feet until only that spot was showing. And then Rashi says, therefore Tzipora understood that it was because of the bris, because of circumcision, that he did not circumcise the child, that he was going to be punished and that he was going to get the death penalty. If you remember from last time, Moshe did not rush to do the bris, to do the circumcision, of his son Eliezer. And so therefore, since he pushed it off to take care of practical business, namely settling in to the motel that he was going to, so therefore it says that God met him and God wanted to kill him. So the Medrash says, Moshe! So the Medrash says that what happened was that an angel of God, a messenger of God, came in the form of a snake, swallowed Moshe from his head, and then started swallowing him from his feet until the only thing that was sticking out was that part of his body, okay, that you do the circumcision on.
And so therefore, when Tzipora saw that, so she realized the reason why he was getting the death penalty was because he did not carry out the circumcision of Eliezer. Okay? The reason why it was that part of the body that stuck out was to show that the violation, what he violated, was that he didn't do a circumcision on his son Eliezer, and he pushed it off to take care of practical things. I've seen it in the Ibn Ezra, and I've seen it in the Barbanel, it's probably other Rishonim, that say that the Medrash, a miracle like this, when the Medrash writes a miracle like this, so the question is, if it was such a big miracle, then why wasn't it written in Torah? If this is what really happened, then it should have been written in Torah. This is the purpose of Torah, to write all about all the miracles. Why did they put it in such a way? They should have written openly the miracle. The Torah tells us all the miracles that happened to the Avos, and therefore they hold that all these Midrashim that talk about unbelievable miracles that happen, the Ibn Ezra and the Abarbanel hold that you can't take it literally. That this is what literally happened. Okay? What the Midrash is telling us is there was something that happened. It wasn't an open miracle. That implied, in other words, Moshe got very sick. You see, he couldn't do it. Zipporah had to do it. Moshe got the message, he would have done it. For some reason, Moshe was incapacitated. And only Zipporah had to do it, but it was in such a way that it wasn't in line with the laws of nature. There's two types of miracles. There's a miracle, an obvious miracle, where God suspends the laws of nature. He makes water into a rock. Okay? But then there's Hashgacha Pratis, which it's in the laws of nature, but if you know how to define when it is the laws of nature, when God is intervening, you can know when God is intervening, but it has to come through Chachma, through interpretation, by understanding how to interpret these type of things. You see? So Tzipora understood how to interpret the situation. So what the Medrash is saying is there was a situation where Moshe was incapacitated, and that somehow that situation was not within the laws of nature, and it pointed to the way he was incapacitated, it pointed to the problem that he made a mistake about the circumcision, you see? And therefore Tzipora, in other words, it wasn't that she went and did the bris. She realized there was something there, our sages are saying. It's not exactly in this way, but that's the way our sages wrote. But it's not an open miracle, because the Ibn Ezra and the Abarbanel said that if it was an open miracle, that this really happened, then it would have been written in Torah. We're going to do a pasuk in the Bereishis, Genesis, and it's chapter 1, verse 26, and it says, "And God said, let us make man in our image, in our form, and he shall rule over the fish of the sea and the fowl of the heaven," etc. Okay, but anyway, the main question, it's the second Rashi that says, let us make man, Nasa Adam. It's the second one. And Rashi says like this: although the angels did not assist in man's creation, and there is room for heretics. A heretic is a person that's against a certain religion. Okay? So he says, for the heretics to claim supremacy, it means that they will have a proof that they are right, that there's more than one God. So despite the fact that these heretics would have a question against Torah because it says, and let us make man, and they could interpret it as two gods speaking. The Torah did not refrain from teaching us proper conduct and the trait of humility. Okay? What is that? That a great permission from the lesser one. And if it would have written, I made man, or I shall make man, we would not have learned or understood this, that he was speaking to his court. Okay? And we wouldn't have learned this lesson. Okay? That's basically what Rashi says. Okay. Now, the question is that it is no doubt about it. And Rashi actually says that nobody had to assist God in creating the human. So why did he ask permission or speak to his court? Court means the angels. Why did he speak to them? And why did he ask their permission to do this? And I mean, it's a very nice metaphor, but did something really happen? Well, the whole thing is a fake out. It never really happened, but God wrote it this way just to teach us a lesson. Or did something really happen that we could learn a lesson? Something really happened, then I don't understand what happened. What, did he ask permission from them to build the human? Doesn't make sense. So the question is, what happened? I think the answer is like this, that when you, let's say for instance you want to plant a tree. So you dig the hole, you put the seed in, you cover it, and you water it. But then the laws of nature take over, and the laws of nature cause the seed to develop into a tree. Okay, there's a certain amount you could do, and then the laws of nature take over. Okay? When God created the world, he made the first step, like he caused the Big Bang, let there be light, caused the first step. But if, so the same thing when God created the Big Bang, so after that there was an evolutionary process. In other words, what followed after the Big Bang was the laws of nature. God allowed the Lord, what was going to happen was in the nature, in the laws of nature, was in there. In other words, God had to create the first step, but everything that followed is the laws of nature. So therefore you see that God did the first step, but then the laws of nature, that's what means the angels, the Rambam says that angels could also mean laws of nature. But they do, an angel or a malach is a messenger of God. And the messenger of God is the laws of nature. So at that point, the laws of nature took over. So in that way, he's saying, we created. In other words, I did the first step, but then the laws of nature took over. Of course, God created all the laws of nature too. But the law, in other words, we're not saying God didn't do the creation. But however, the way he set up the creation was that the laws of nature take over. He maintains the laws of nature, but the laws of nature take over. What's going to happen is going to be a result of the laws of nature. That is what it means, we made man. Because it's me that started it, and it's the angels or the laws of nature that worked, that continued on it. Okay? And the thing is, so when we should learn humility, that, see, the human has two ways of looking at life. He could look at life through his ego, that everything was made for him, and he should make decisions based on his feelings, or he should look around and see that there's a system here, and to recognize that he must live by the system. God created the system, and the system, he gave the system the right to take over, to continue and to work on it, Now, I must recognize that I am part and parcel of the system. That is humility. Humility recognizes that I am not above the system, but I am part and parcel of the system. In other words, the God that created the system, but then what follows in the system is inherently part and parcel of the system itself. It's true, God created the system, but what happens in the system is based inherently in the nature of the system. In Vayikra, that's Leviticus, chapter 13, verse 47, the Ramban, Nachmanides, says that the saras, it's a spiritual disease, which is incorrectly translated as leprosy. Leprosy is a physical disease. This is a spiritual disease, and the Ramban says that it's not in the laws of nature. No doctor could cure you. A kohen, a priest, has to decide that when you have the disease, and a priest decides when you are cured of the disease. But it's outside the laws of nature. Now he says that the disease of Tzoras can only occur when the Jews not only have captured the land, not only when they're in the land, but when they captured the land and they have divided the land and they're settled and they're totally comfortable, okay, and they're keeping all the mitzvahs, they totally relate to God, and one individual violates something and God punishes them and gives them tzaras. That is what Nachmanides, the Ramban, says. The Sephorno also in that same verse says that tzaras, that disease of tzaras, shows God's compassion to Israel. Okay? Shows God's compassion in general. Okay? And he says also that it has to be, it can only be to Israel. This disease can only happen to an Israelite. And it could only happen when we're in the land. And it only happens to rare people who are on the level of receiving this punishment. Okay? And he repeats himself that this is compassion. And he also mentions that Shemitah is every 7 years we have to let the land go fallow. It says, and if we violate the Shemitah, if we do business on Shemitah, okay, so then we'll start losing money, not making money, even though it seems like we'll make more money, we'll lose money. And this is also God's compassion. When he makes you lose money, that is God's compassion. And the question is, wherein lies God's compassion? The main point that I'd like to show with God's compassion is the commandment of Tzaras, the disease of Tzaras, that the Sephorno says it can only occur to a certain type of person. And I'd like to explain that type of person. That type of person, first of all, there are two attitudes. There are two attitudes to misfortune. Whenever misfortune happens, certain people say, why did it happen to me? They start questioning God. They complain. Terrible. They feel a terrible thing. That's one thing. That's one way of relating to it. Another way of relating to misfortune is, yes, I feel bad that I had this misfortune, but what can I learn from the misfortune? How did I react to it? How do I deal with it? There's something to learn from it. You see, what emotions were evoked? How did I think at the time You see, so there is a, you use misfortune as a means of development. Okay? That's one thing that, yeah, that's one quality. The first quality is that you use misfortune as a means for development. The second thing is you must know how to use misfortune to develop. There is a method. Both these things, this attitude, and the method of investigation, of how to investigate misfortune, is through the study of Torah. If you reach the level where your attitude is that you immediately investigate when you have a misfortune, you investigate, you have the attitude to investigate, and two, you have the method of investigation, only that type of person can get saras. Only that person, if you reach, in other words, if you haven't reached that level of development, you cannot get the disease of saras. Why is that? Because the thing is that our emotions, is the, and how much our emotions are in line with reality and in line with God, that is a large portion of our development. Since it's a large portion of our development, the more we're able to cure of it, the closer we get to God. Like, for instance, Yaakov was separated from his son Yosef for 22 years. And it bothered him. He knew to do the investigation. He did the investigation. But it did bother him. I mean, his son died. And because of that, he couldn't get prophecy. He couldn't get prophecy, because to get prophecy, you have to be in a happy state. Not only a level of development, but you must be in a happy state to get prophecy. So therefore, he couldn't get prophecy because he wasn't in that happy state, and yet God kept him in the dark about that. His son was still alive for 22 years to help him develop. There was a development that Yaakov was going through. So you see that that development is more important to God than receiving prophecy. Because God wanted to help Yaakov develop, and to do that, Yaakov had to be unhappy. Therefore, he couldn't receive prophecy. So you see, that development is more important than prophecy. You see? And now, Tzaras is a good situation for development, because one of the things of Tzaras, when you get Tzaras, you're separated and by yourself for 7 days. That 7 days gives you time to work out and to repent and to do tshuva over any sins that you've done, to cure yourself. But that's only if you have the attitude. So therefore, God will only punish a person that has this attitude. But if a person doesn't have this attitude, he will not give tzaras. He will not give tzaras to. You say, why? Because that is just hurting the person for no reason. Just hurting the person for no reason. And God will not hurt a person if there's no reason. So the only time he gives tzaras is if you're ready to use the catastrophe for development. If you're not ready to use the catastrophe for development, then God will not punish you. Okay? That is God. That's why the Sefurno says, you see God's compassion from here. Okay? Now I know that this will open up a tremendous amount of questions of wherein lies God's justice, because there's so many terrible things that happen in the world, and there are many of them. All I could tell you is that if you answer it this clearly, that you see that it is a benefit, then you have the answer. If you can't answer it this clearly, then know that you don't have the answer. it must be this clear that God will not hurt anybody unless there is a benefit. Even though there are people hurt in the world, right? So, but the thing is that, but when, however you work out your answer, it must be this clear that it is for a benefit. The question is, what does he do for the other person that does not have, that's not on the level to reach, to have tzaras, so that he can't cure himself, because the misfortune will not help him? What he has given that person is Torah. The purpose of Torah is to get this, one of the purposes of Torah, one of the benefits, I'll say, I'll put it this way, one of the benefits of Torah is to get this lifestyle, this view of life, that when a catastrophe happens, you have met, you immediately go to investigate a certain type of investigation that you train from Torah, and you have the knowledge of how to investigate. That is how you reach the level. So therefore he gave the people Torah. Whether they choose to follow Torah, to study Torah, that's free choice. But God gave them the Torah to guide them. But they're not on the level to be punished, because they haven't reached that level. It's only through Torah that you could reach that level to be punished. This also answers the question that some people hold, that they asked me the question that certain commentaries hold that God's personal supervision, Hashgacha Pratis, is only on people on a certain level. Because part of God's supervision is not to reward you, but to also punish you. The higher the level, God can intervene to punish you in particular. So therefore, and on the contrary, it could be that the higher you get, the more punishment you get, because God is trying to help you. So, but the only thing is for God to intervene to do this for you is you must recognize the benefit. If not, God will not intervene with you, because then it's only harming you, it's only hurting you. So therefore, he gives you the Torah to get the development to reach the level. And then once you've reached the level, then God will put you in certain situations where it's beneficial for your development, even though it will be extremely painful, will bother you. But however, it'll be part of your development, and that way you'll get closer to God. Right? The question is, according to this, if you're wicked, then it comes out you will not be punished. Okay? In other words, according to laws of nature inherently, the wicked person is punished. I mean, inherently, he's going to be punished. Okay? That we've discussed many times. But however, would God intervene? Yes. God intervenes in certain times where they are so bad that he removes them from the physical world. But not a punishment to help them, but a punishment because they've reached such a low level that there is no hope for them to repent anymore, and their existence is of no value insofar as God is concerned, insofar as their relationship to God, which is the essence of what we're put in this world for, is to relate to God. That essence is gone. And so therefore, since they reach a level where they can't, they're so involved in the physical attachment to the physical world, where they can't do tshuva, where they can't repent, then God has the right. I don't say he always does it, but then God has the right to destroy them. You see? But however, the punishment to help people get back on the track, that's only reserved for the person that's on the level that he can be helped. In chapter 5, verse 1, it says, "And afterwards Moshe and Aaron said to Paro, so said God, the God of Israel, send my nation and let him celebrate to me in the desert." So Rashi says, "And afterwards Moshe and Aaron came," says, "but the elders slipped away one by one from behind Moshe and Aaron until all of them slipped away before they reached the palace. And because they were afraid to go, they were punished by Sinai that they didn't come up close, but they stood back with the nation. There were certain people, because of their level, would come up higher on the mountain based on their level, and the elders should have been higher on the mountain more than the other people, but God kept them back with the public because of punishment, because they were afraid from going to the palace. The first thing that we have to prove is where Rashi got this information that the elders were supposed to go to Paro. How do we know that the elders were supposed to go to Paro? Because in chapter 4, verse 29, it says, "And Moshe and Aaron went and gathered all the elders of Israel, and he spoke to them everything. He spoke to them and told them everything that God said to him, before miracles." And it says, "The nation trusted God, and they listened, and they accepted the idea that God had remembered them." Okay? So, and they really saw, they recognized that God saw their affliction. Okay? And so Rashi held that they, when he gathered them, not only was he supposed to show that he was a messenger of God, but they were also supposed to go with him as a whole committee to come to Paro. Okay? Rashi says, and then the next passage says, "And Moshe and Aaron came," not the elders. In our verse 1, it says that just Moshe and Aaron came and not the elders. Now the question is, why were they punished? Okay? These people were raised in Egypt from childhood on. They're raised as slaves to fear Paro, and that's an inherent part of them. And so, look, they should have some leeway if they're still afraid to face Paro. They should have some leeway. The question is, why is it that they were punished? The punishment was that they couldn't stay up on the mountain. But whatever the punishment was, why did God hold them responsible? I mean, these people have a slave mentality. They were in slavery. They were raised in slavery. The people were in slavery for 200 years. That means these people were raised in slavery, so they have a certain mentality. I mean, what is it? What was the catastrophe, mistake, that they have to be punished? Can we find some excuse for them? Aaron wants to have a bigger question, raising the question to a great extent, because it says that they slipped away from behind Moshe and Aaron, which shows that they had the way they were raised, they had certain fear of authority, a greater fear of authority than God. That's the way they were raised. It's not only Paro that they were afraid of, but they couldn't turn away from Moshe and Aaron and say, "Look, we can't do this." They had to sneak away. So it shows even stronger, this is a powerful, powerful emotion. So the question is why should they be punished? I mean, we see how powerful the emotion is. In other words, it says clearly that they were afraid to go. That's what Rashi says. They snuck away because they were afraid to go. We're only adding, not only were they afraid of Paro, but they were also afraid of authority that you see from them sneaking away. But the sin seems to be, what they were punished for, is because they were afraid to go to the palace, to face Paro. That seems to be what the punishment was for. Now, the thing is like this. All free will, whenever you have free will, you have to make a decision. It's always a conflict between what you know with your mind and your emotions don't want to go there. Okay? It is possible to know something with your mind, 100% true, and yet your emotions tell you not to do it. That is free will. That is the conflict of free will. Okay? That is the conflict of free will. Now, the thing is they saw a miracle, and God and Moshe proved that Moshe was the messenger of that Moshe. They knew for sure. It says that they trusted Moshe. It says that it was true to them. It was without a doubt that Moshe was sent by God. They knew this fact. Yet simultaneously, they had a fear of going to Paro. Now, the truth that Moshe was sent by God should have been enough for them to overcome this emotion. In fact, this is what God is demanding of Paro too. Paro, who was raised in the center of all magic and all superstition, he was raised in superstition and magic and idols. When God showed him a miracle, he's saying, I want you to go against everything that you accept emotionally and follow your mind. If you don't, that is being stubborn. You see? So the thing is that the Jews were on a higher level than Paro. Paro wouldn't even allow the thought to enter his mind that their God is true. In other words, Paro wouldn't even allow the truth to come in his mind. Even when he saw the miracles, as soon as it was over, he would quit. He didn't see the truth. But here the Jews, with their mind, saw the truth. They are on a level where they do accept God. Now the question is, can they live with the ramifications of that truth? The ramifications of that truth is they should not be afraid to face Paro. Or even if they feel fear, even when they come in front of Paro, they might feel fear, but they should carry it out because of their knowledge and truth of God. You see? It says, so therefore that was what was wrong. When you know, the mind knew, there was a miracle they accepted, but the emotion was contrary to that knowledge, they had enough information to make a decision. Okay? Therefore, because they didn't stand up, they didn't accept God 100%, then that said they didn't have the right to stand on a higher level on Har Sinai. Their conviction about God was only in the mind, but it couldn't, and they would carry it out, but not when it went against strong emotions. Conviction about God must be so strong that it stands up to all emotions. Now, that doesn't mean they didn't accept God. They accept God. And it was a problem. And we can't say they're equal to Paro. They're not equal to Paro, because Paro, even under reality, when they saw the miracle, when he saw the miracle, they still didn't accept it. That's a total disregard for reality. But however, they accepted God, so they're not punished, they're going to be killed like Paro or destroyed. But however, what their punishment was, to show that they didn't have that conviction to go totally against their emotions, then they didn't deserve to go higher on the mountain when it came to go closer, to get closer to God. Then they had to stay with the public.
So are you saying
they knew it, but they couldn't practically apply it where it went totally against this very deep emotion of fear of Paro and their nature to face up. They couldn't face up to authority. You see that by Moshe and Aaron. They couldn't even tell Moshe and Aaron, we don't want to go. They couldn't even say, we're afraid to go. You see? But however, under the truth, where you see without a doubt, where your mind sees without a doubt the truth, then it must also be that you live by that idea contrary to your emotion. There are sometimes, just for clarification, there are sometimes that, let's say, for instance, like Yaakov made a mistake in raising his child and gave him a coat of many colors. The reason for that is because he thought that Yosef deserved it. So his emotions, he didn't see the truth because his emotions affected his thinking process. So he didn't even see the truth. Therefore, God had to put him in a situation to force him to see that emotion. You see? But in this case, the nation, the Zakenim, the elders, saw and knew and accepted. The Torah testifies that they knew God in their mind. It wasn't that it was questionable, that the emotion was so powerful that it was questionable. They knew the fact that it's very different than where it's such a subtle proof that the emotion fakes you out. You see what I mean? That is different than where the mind sees it and you know this is the truth, but the emotion doesn't let you carry it out. So here we see three levels of your relationship to truth. One is I paro that denies the truth. One is I know the truth, but I can't carry it out in certain situations because of powerful emotions. And then there is where the truth is so subtle and such a borderline case that the emotion makes me make an error in seeing what the truth is. That's the most subtle. Okay? That is the difference between the three levels. And the question is by Yosef, what did Yaakov think about? How did he think rationally to give Yosef a coat of many colors? He held that Yosef, which he was right about, that Yosef was born to be a leader, that his nature was to be born a leader. And therefore he had to raise him differently than the other brothers. Okay? And that he was correct. You must raise your child, based on knowing their nature, who they are, to raise them according to their nature. Okay? But because he was the son of Rachel, and that his emotion affected him, that he gave him the coat of many colors, which really that he shouldn't have done. In other words, he should raise him different than the others, and he should give to him something different than the others because of his leadership qualities. But the coat of many colors shows why the ego was brought out in Yosef, and that also brought out the sibling rivalry from the brothers. You see? He thought, consciously, he deserves this because he should be raised differently, but that was the mistake where the emotion faked him out. You see, that was very subtle because he deserved to be raised differently because of his leadership qualities. If it was done correctly without the emotion, then Yaakov would have had in mind Yosef not to go too far and also where it would affect the brother-sibling rivalry. He was a chacham. He knew psychology. He understood the nature of his children. He would have been very careful about that idea. But it's only where the emotion affected him that he brought out Yosef's ego and he brought out the sibling rivalry of the brothers. In other words, he thought that it was right to give him the coat of many colors and not the others. He thought that that would help him in his leadership qualities. What he didn't notice is that his emotions was affecting him. That's what he didn't notice. It was very, very subtle. That's what he didn't notice. He didn't know Yosef was superior. He held Yosef had leadership qualities, and they didn't. Therefore, he has to be raised to develop the leadership qualities, and they should be raised to develop their qualities. Right, we're in Exodus, Chapter 5, verse 8, and the Paro told the taskmasters and the policemen that enforced the rulings that they should not help them. Before this, they were given the straw, and they had to make the bricks and build the cities that they were obligated to build. Now, the Egyptians will not give them straw, They have to get their own straw, but the quota or the total amount of bricks that they have to make would not change. They have to have that quota or total that they're obligated. They're getting extra work, and they have to produce the same amount. And Paro explains that they are free. What does it mean, free? So Rashi says, the word free is not exactly a translation. It's really, what it means is that they have too much hands, too much time on their hands. In other words, they are free from the work. They have, in other words, they have free time, certain amount of free time from their work. It says, and therefore, their heart turns towards total freedom, towards total neglect, and therefore they say, let us go sacrifice to our God. Okay? That is the Pasuk and Rashi. Okay? What Rashi is telling us, Paro understood that a person that has free time, his mind goes towards more free time, and he learns to hate burdens, and he tries to turn away from burdens. Okay? I'll try and give you an example. Years ago, men had to work. They didn't only work 8-hour days. They could work 10, 12 hours, 13 hours. Women had to work very hard too. Then suddenly we had things that helped us. For instance, we had washing machines, dishwashers. Suddenly the woman had more time, the men had more time, and so they got involved in leisure to such an extent that people hate responsibility, they're in terrible conflict. So therefore, that's what Paro was saying. The more time you have, the more you think of being free. So it must be you have free time, therefore you're thinking of this. Okay? So therefore, to stop you from thinking of this, I'm going to give you more work, so you shouldn't have time to think about freedom. Okay? And it really is a true idea. When we were practical, when we didn't have leisure time, people worked. I mean, it bothered them a certain amount, but they had a attitude of responsibility. But then the more free time we had, then there was an attitude of, I hate responsibility, because I had time to think of all the things I could do if I don't have responsibility, and I started being able to hate responsibility. So that idea is a true idea that Paro was saying. Okay? That's one idea. Okay? So the question is, what is Paro doing wrong? He's right. These people, the slaves, are going to get lost. You know what I mean? They're going to stop working. He's going to lose all this money that he's making from it. You understand all the benefits he has from slaves, right? So the question is, what is he doing wrong? The answer is, there's a pasuk in Mishlei. It's Perek chapter 22, verse 13. In other words, the question is that what's wrong is he did evil, he's doing evil. That happens to be true, he's doing evil by forcing them to be slaves. But I'm saying in this argument, you understand, what is wrong with the argument, insofar as this argument itself, forgetting about the overall picture of that he was an evil person, that he was enforcing people and tormenting them also. But in other words, okay? In other words, inherent in this thing. So in Proverbs chapter 22, verse 13, it says, the lazy person says, there is a lion in the streets, and if I go in the streets, I'll be murdered. That's the whole verse. So what is he saying? What is King Solomon saying with this? He says a lazy person has the craziest excuses for not He's exaggerating, of course. I mean, he's using exaggeration to bring a point out that the lazy person always finds crazy excuses not to work. You see? You know what I mean? Like, I remember when I was young in class, so a kid didn't do his homework. So he says, I'm telling you, this time I did it, but I made it into an airplane and it was hijacked. You understand? So there's always, people have, of course it's an exaggeration, but it really, that is the argument of the lazy person. If you listen to lazy people, you see they have the craziest arguments. Okay? But somehow you have to distinguish between where an argument is crazy and when an argument is real. You see? He said, Paro understood this idea that lazy people give crazy excuses. Says, oh, suddenly you want to go pray to your God? Says, that's crazy. What do you mean all of a sudden, suddenly your God out of the blue wants you to go pray? That's an excuse for laziness. It's an extreme thing. You see? But what Moshe was trying to prove, which you should have seen with the miracle of the snake and then later on with the other miracles, you see, he should have seen, Paro should have seen that there's some reality here. You must distinguish between the excuse that is an excuse to, just an excuse to get out of responsibility, and when an excuse is a real excuse. Sometimes it really is an excuse. Like, I'll give you an example. Today, the question is the backache. They say, doctors say, that if you have a real lower backache, if you don't work, or if you do work, it lasts the same amount of time. They took statistics. So unconsciously, it could be that certain times backache is really an excuse not to work. Because it's not going to stop you from working. It's not really hurt you. It's not a real harm. But sometimes it could be a real harm. So you have to distinguish when it's an unconscious thing, I understand. But still, all, sometimes it could be an unconscious excuse to escape from work, to get out of responsibility. Sometimes it could be a reality. You have to distinguish between the two. When it's used for laziness and when it's a reality, it's not an excuse, but it's a reality, and you should take off from work. So the thing is, that's the mistake that Paro made inherently here, is that he took a real excuse and said it's just a lazy person giving, saying it's just an exaggeration to get out of work. That was his mistake here. In other words, the two ideas which we said here were real ideas. In other words, that Paro said that sometimes people have too much time. They shouldn't. They should have practical things to do, not total pleasure. They should learn responsibility at all times and not allow laziness to creep in and the excuses of laziness to creep in. That is a real idea, but in a free society, you have to do it upon yourself. You have to work on yourself to work out your life, that you don't have this lazy attitude and you're always looking for excuses out. But the second thing is, you have to know when your excuse out is only excuse for laziness or when it's a reality. You have to distinguish between the two. And you have to use that in everyday life.